Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by my two wonderful and gracious co-hosts, Big Bad Bobby Simmons and the David Hasselhoff of Tybee Island, Jerry Baywatch Oates. How you guys doing?
Boy.
You written any tickets this week?
No, I went to court. Tuesday on one. Bobby, what kind of bad news have you got this week, sir?
Well, I don't really. I guess Chris Drake passed away this week, and I hate to have lost her, a great friend, and. She told my wife one time, she was being an attorney, she told her, she said, if Bobby ever gets in trouble, she said, you call me and I'll come get him. So I really have to behave now.
Yeah, you're on your own, right?
Yeah, I'm on my own again. So, other than that, you know, I mean, it's kind of quiet. I'm sure the Nashville is hopping with all those guys going into town tonight for the little get-together this weekend. So, other than that, I'm looking forward to the weekend, man. They're talking highs of, like, low 70s and no humidity, and it's supposed to be pretty.
Well, how are your Falcons going to do this week?
You know, I predict they'll show up for every game, but as far as winning any, I don't know.
Who are they playing this week?
They play Seattle this week, and they've had the kiss of death put on them because they're favored to win. And they really look horrible. They look horrible. They come back home next week and play Green Bay on national TV, so that should be exciting.
They've got the Saints. Are the Saints playing up there in 2 weeks?
Let's see. I know the Saints are up here, but I don't know when.
I think it's in 2 weeks because I think they play this Sunday, then they've got a bye. They've got a week off, and then they're playing Atlanta, and I'm thinking, and I'm hoping they're in Atlanta and not here.
It is in Atlanta. They don't play there, and they play in New Orleans on a Monday night, the day after Christmas.
Well, you know, before this is all said and done, Arthur Blank's going to wish he was still selling 2x4s.
I heard that. I just, he's going through a divorce.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He had this lovely young bride, and they had a little child about 8 or 9 years old, and they're going through a divorce. They're keeping it as hush-hush as they can, but I can just imagine she ain't going to have to worry about looking for work no time soon.
She may end up owning the Falcons.
Well... It's going to be interesting. I'm enjoying my Georgia Tech tickets more than I am the Falcons this year. They playing like they got good sense out there.
Do you catch all their home games too, Bobby?
Yeah, I have season tickets for them too. Football's my therapy, Jerry. I love football, and thank God
too,
for
Bobby.
An understanding wife. It's her therapy too because I'm gone on Saturdays and Sundays to the games, you know. But
that would be relief for her, I'm sure.
I've got a radio. It's like a headphone radio, and I take my binoculars and I go to the games, and I just kind of let the world quit spinning for about 3 hours. And
well, that's what it's supposed to be
that's,
for.
That's what it is for me. I just I love it, and plus it gets me away from everything. So I had to. You know, pastoring a church is what I feel like I'm supposed to be doing, but I went to Eddie Smith's funeral Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Then I left there and came all the way back down and had to go to a a friend of mine that was in a funeral home here in Atlanta. Then I had a funeral on Monday. So it's I need those weekend getaways for 2 or 3 hours.
Everybody's got to have something they'll enjoy.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You know, if you don't, what's it all about?
Well, I got a question for you. How many snakes you have to deal with down there?
None? No, because they know I'm definitely afraid of them.
Well, I was fixing to say, there's four kind of snakes I don't like. Big ones, little ones, live ones, and dead ones.
You're in the same boat as on. Let me tell you, this was 2 weeks ago. It was on a Saturday. But Friday, before that, it was all at lunch, and we got talking about snakes. And they said, you don't like them things, do you? I said, man, heck no. I'm definitely afraid of them. So we had lunch again Saturday. I don't work on Saturdays now anymore because of the, you know, summer's really gone. So anyhow, we was talking about it at lunch. About 30 minutes later, I get a call. Dispatcher said there's a large snake at this certain address. I said, 10-4. I got over there. There was four police cars beat me there to get it. I was afraid. And it was about 8 inches long, and they had said it was a huge snake, and it was already dead. And this guy that's the marshal, he just picked it up and threw it in the bushes. But when I pulled up, they were dying laughing. Four police cars beat me there.
I love it. We were at Atlanta TV. You remember we used to dress in the, you know, in the lobby of 17 there.
Yes, sir.
The station on West Peace Street. And the sheep was there that Saturday, and he had that snake, and they had throwed that thing in the floor. And it was just kind of crawling around. And I was sitting over in the corner, and I was watching it. And all of a sudden, somebody hollered. I took my eye off of it, did something else, and somebody hollered, "Where's the snake?" And I looked over, son, and that snake was gone. Now, this was an 8-9 foot boa constrictor. It was gone. I'm like, uh-oh. I looked around, looked in my bag, you know, and zipped it up. So finally somebody got up and turned the sofa over, and in the bottom of the sofa there was a hole there about 6-8 inches around where the lining had a hole in it on the bottom of the sofa, and that snake had crawled up in that hole and was up there in the springs of that sofa. They turned that sofa over and they looked over at me and said, "We'll hold the sofa. You run your hand up in there and get it." I said, "Pal," I don't even remember who told me. I said, "Pal," I said, "if you waiting on me to run my hand up in there, that snake's going to live there and raise grandkids."
Yeah, he can run 17 as far as you're concerned.
Yes, sir. I am not reaching up in there.
I know. I just, you know, I mean, as a kid, I didn't fool with lizards or frogs or nothing.
No.
That wasn't my thing.
Nope. I told him at church one time, I said, "If I ever get bit by a snake and it kills me, and it bit me anywhere other than the backs of my legs or the cheeks of my butt, I said, somebody has murdered me. Call the police."
You sound like me, man. I just...
Well, I guess neither one of you would like to watch the movie Snakes on a Plane, then, would you?
No, I wasn't there to watch that.
No, my wife watched it, but Bobby didn't.
Snakes
on a Plane. And don't think I didn't think about that flying to Vegas, too.
Yeah, I ain't got nothing for that.
I'm not fond of snakes, either. I like the same four kind that Bobby does, or don't like the same four kind.
You know, I was in a lot of matches, you know, over the years with the sheep, when he would bring that snake in the ring, and he'd wrap it around some guy, and, you know, I mean, I told Ernesto one time, I said, "Tom, I ain't ever refused to do anything you ask me to do, but if he comes at me with that snake, he's going to be there by himself." And, of course, he just laughed at me. But you know,
I wouldn't
just
go for that. There ain't no way.
No. I'd have had a heart attack or something. I mean, I ain't as bad as, I mean, I don't scream and yell like Armstrong does, but and tear down buildings, but I don't want no part of them.
Mike, maybe Bobby and I could get a snake act with you guys.
Yeah.
They think it was two clowns out there is what
No, I'd be aiming that cannon at the snake and flying through the air.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm about that cannon. when I was a kid, I always thought I wanted to be an astronaut. And then I went to Cape Canaveral and actually seen the size of one of them rockets. And I figured out real quick that I didn't want no part of that. And after seeing that cannon at the circus, I don't want no part of that either.
Yeah, it's funny how people think they want to do something until they actually see what it is.
Oh, geez. I walked up beside that Saturn V down there at Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy, whatever they call it then. And it was laying on its side. It was one like they sent to the moon. And it said sitting on top of this thing was the equivalent of a number about 3 feet long, cases of dynamite when it's ignited. And I thought, I don't think so.
Have you ever been to a NASCAR race?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was in Atlanta one Sunday. I was sitting up there, and they turned them loose. And, you know, it was about 20 laps into it. Some joker sitting next to me, he said, I could do that. I said, really? Well, why are you sitting up here with me then? That's not what you think either.
No, sir.
That is not what you think.
Them guys out there running 200 miles an hour, and they're 3 inches from each other.
That's what I'm trying to tell. And those cars are moving sideways and back and forth. You know, it's all that turbulence. Man, come on. People are crazy.
I can't imagine that. I don't even like riding the car with Ron West. I can't imagine that.
But don't get one in the car with Garvin. That's all I can tell you.
And don't ever ride in that little Volkswagen Rabbit with John Walker either.
No, sir. I've made that run a time or two.
I rode with him to Chattanooga, Tennessee one time, and he thought that rabbit had wings.
He turned it loose, didn't he?
That's the only time he ever scared me. I rode with him a lot of miles. That's the only time he ever scared me. But, son, the only time that rabbit touched the ground was when it hit the little high spots on the hills. Ooh.
We're going to be talking about Tennessee wrestling this evening, and I have two people who represent Tennessee wrestling, one in the past, one in the present, and hopefully into the future. Our first guest this evening is going to be Billy Wicks, who works in a lot of different territories, but is probably best known for his time in Memphis and the feud he had up there with Sputnik Monroe. So let me try and get Mr. Wicks on the phone with us and see what he can enlighten us with. Well, that didn't work. I'm sitting here typing numbers and the machine's not there.
He's not using Donnie Fargo's phone, is he? Bobby.
Yes, sir. Michael may be on Fargo's phone. Kind of fading in now.
Hello.
Billy.
Yo.
Hey, it's Michael Norris, Bobby Simmons, and Jerry Oates with Peace Safe Pandemonium. How are you this evening?
How you doing, Mike? You up in Cleveland?
No, I'm actually in Slidell, Louisiana right now.
Whereabouts?
In Slidell, Louisiana.
Slidell. I used to wrestle down in Lafayette a lot.
Yeah, you sure did.
I love Louisiana. Great territory.
I've had a lot of fun since I've been down there this past couple of weeks. And I got Bobby Simmons, who's in Atlanta, and Jerry Oates, who's in Savannah, on the line with us as well.
Oh, great, great, great. Bobby Simmons?
Yes, sir.
The real Bobby Simmons that I know?
The real one from Mobile, yes, sir.
How about that?
We have sure missed you down there, sir.
Well, I can't get around with the dam anymore. I'm basically homebound. I just can't go any place. I guess you call a crippled up old man.
Oh, well, you sound pretty good to me. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, well, I'm pushing that 80 mark.
Well, I use I adopted Charlie Smith's philosophy. I want to live to be 120 and get shot by a jealous husband.
That's old Charlie, all right.
One of the funniest things I ever heard. We were one of the first couple of years I went to Mobile, Michael. We were staying. Rocket was Monroe was staying with me, and we were in the room, and Billy and Sputnik, and there were several guys standing outside on the sidewalk right outside our room, and we were listening to them. And Sputnik made the comment. He said, people used to think I had a real loud mouth. And I'll never forget Billy jumping right in his face. And he goes, I cannot believe anybody would ever say that about you.
he was the sweet man, all right.
Yes, he was.
I heard from his wife, Joanne. I heard from her today.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm going to pass this on to you for whatever it's worth, if you don't mind. Anybody out there that's going to hear us or that's interested, give me my email. I want to give you my email address. Tell them to ask me a question or make a comment or whatever. My email address is Willie Bix, WILLYBICKS, Willie Bix at bellsouth.net.
All right. We'll certainly pass that along.
You got that? Willie Bix at bellsouth.net. I just changed it from Billy Wick to Willie Bix.
Now, Billy, you're from Minnesota originally, correct? St. Paul?
Right, St. Paul, Minnesota.
And you got started in the at shows, or did you do any kind of amateur type wrestling prior to that?
Well, I met a guy when I was 15 years old. I met a fellow named Quentin Dale Clark. He was 21 or 22 years old, and he actually introduced me to wrestling. You know, like I said, I was 15. He was 22, and he was a real powerful kid. He weighed 160 pounds, but he did 30 repetitions with 400 pounds in a squat. And a body weight of 160 pounds, that is pretty damn good. He was a powerful kid, very strong. In fact, I ran him down here about 2 years ago. He lives out in Auburn, California. He's 85 years old now.
Hmm.
Wow.
Billy, you and Greg Peterson kind of got started about the same time, didn't you?
Right. We both worked at shows. Yeah.
Oh,
sure,
okay.
Yeah, I got educated on the at show by an old fella. He was about 59 or 60 years old. He was one of Farmer Burns' students. His name was Henry Colon. And that old man used to stretch my ass something big. He taught me the ins and outs of hook wrestling, they call it, you know, catch wrestling. But I got a student I've been training for the last 12 years. His name is Johnny Husky. And you talk about a good, tough sucker. Are we alive now or what?
We are.
But anyway, I got to plug Johnny Husky. He is one of the best I've ever had. But in fact, he's the only guy I've really actually trained at wrestling. And he is phenomenal. In fact, he has a school over in Arden, North Carolina called Black Eye MMA Training Academy.
Is that what he's involved in, is a mixed martial arts type thing?
Right. You know, I taught him wrestling, and he progressed into MMA stuff, so he's got fighters. In fact, they're having a fight show tonight, or tomorrow night, I think. Tomorrow or Saturday over in Asheville at Agricultural Center, they have a bunch of fights lined up.
I think I've heard a lot of people make the comparison that MMA is what wrestling used to be without the working aspect of it.
Of course, without the kicking and punching, of course, too.
Right. That what is now classified as professional wrestling is so far away from what it was back in the heyday from the 40s to the early 80s. It's totally different.
Yeah, I just got interviewed here about a year ago. Vince McMahon sent down his reporters, I guess you call it. I had four people come to my house here, and they interviewed me. They're putting together a movie about Gorgeous George, and they found out that I had wrestled him a couple, three times, and they wanted to interview me, so they came down here and spent about 4 hours with me, put up the cameras and the mics and all that stuff, and interviewed me for about 4 hours, and 2 weeks later, I got a check from them for $1,500.
Wow.
I never got a payoff that big.
Yeah, you and George swapped the Gulf Coast title around a couple times down in Mobile.
Yeah, my first match with him was in Mobile, that's right. And he sent word over to my dressing room that he was going to beat me 2 straight falls. And I was the champion, Gulf Coast champion at that time, see. And I said, well, the referee came over and asked me, he said, hey, George says he's going to beat you 2 straight falls. Well, I said, tell the guy if he thinks he can do it to go ahead and give it a try. So he went back and told him, and then the referee came back and said, well, he said, George would like to work a deal. He'd like to get the belt tonight if he could, and then I'd get it back the following week or two. Well, I found out why he wanted that. The belt was because the champion at that time was getting $5 more payoff than anybody else. So he wanted the money. That's what he wanted. But I'll drop the belt to him for a week or so. So I did, you know. Anyway, then I wrestled him again in Memphis at the, I think it was 1958 Christmas wrestling show they had in Memphis.
How was he to work with in the ring? I know he had some. He wasn't a shooter or a hook or anything, but he had some skills as far as working goes.
Yeah, he was a decent, what I call a decent wrestler, you know. But you know, he's basically a showman, you know, because you know he was he was the first guy that so-called brought gimmicks into wrestling, you know, coming down the scene with blonde hair, bleach blonde hair, which was unheard of back in the 40s.
Right.
For a man to bleach his hair blonde, and him coming on with all that sequin robes and his demeanor, you know.
Now, what year did you actually break into the professional, the working end of it?
I was 19 years old, and I started off on the carnivals with this old guy named Henry Colin, stretching my butt, and I worked with the carnivals for from 51 to 56, I worked the carnival scene. And then I was doing house matches for local promoters, too, of course. And then Red Bastien got me in my first territory, which was Portland, Oregon. I went out there in late 57. I spent a summer in Houston, Texas, working down there for Morris Siegel.
Was Don Owens doing, was he running Portland?
Oh, yeah, Don Owens, he was a promoter in Portland, yeah. They used to kid him a lot because he really liked the matches. We used to kid him and say, hey, Mr. Owens, did you buy your ticket yet? Because he liked the matches, he really did.
Gary spent some time out there. This was one of his favorite territories.
Who?
Yeah.
Jerry Oaks, our co-host here.
Was Eric Pedersen out there when you were there?
He sure was. I met Eric Pedersen out there that time. He was a phenomenal guy, man. He was strange.
That's what Don said.
Yeah, he was strange. A hell of a build, man. He had a hell of a build.
Yes, he did. Yeah, Don, Go ahead. No, I'm done. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, did you ever work in the Minnesota territory proper with, I guess, who was it before Gagne had it? I guess Tony Stecker?
Yeah, Tony Stecker and Wally Carbo.
Right.
Yeah, I had a match up there with, I'll never forget this one, with Killer Kowalski. The big Killer Kowalski, and he liked to kill me, boy. He liked to threw me around like a rag.
Well, what brought you south to Homesick? Because I guess you were, after Texas, you came into Mobile, and you kind of split your time between Mobile and Memphis.
Well, I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma for about a month, and then I beat the crap out of a promoter there, a promoter named Jimmy Lott.
Yeah.
At that time in the territory, I was had my wife and three children with me because I didn't want to leave home without them anymore because I was out on the West Coast in Portland, and I didn't want to leave the wife and kids home anymore, so I took them with me, and I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I met an old-time shooter named Tony Morelli. And Tony Morelli had asked me, he said, "Hey, Wicks," he said, "have you ever worked for Fort Smith, Arkansas for Jimmy Lott?" And I said, "No," I said, "not yet." Well, he said, "Watch that son of a bitch." He said, "He's a goddamn thief. He's been stealing from the boys for years." Well, okay, that stuck in my mind. So I worked Fort Smith. You know, we worked Texarkana and Oklahoma City and Springfield and Missouri and Joplin, places like that. So this particular night, what night he ran was on a Thursday, I worked, and we all, at that time, we all got paid in cash right after the match. And we all made $20 that night. Well, the following week was Christmas Day. And he said, "I'm going to run a Christmas show. Does anybody want to work Christmas?" Well, most of the guys were going home for Christmas, but, you know, I was starving. I had my wife and three kids back in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I said, "I'll work, Mr. Lott." And he said, "Okay, Wicks, you're on the main event next week with Con Bruno." Man, following week, Christmas Day or Christmas night, the house had doubled from the week before, and we made $20. Well, I was the last match, and we all got paid, like I said, right after the matches. And I asked the guy, I said, "What's the payoff?" He said, $19.50. I said, "All that bullshit." I said, "We made $20 last week, and the house had doubled since last week." "No," he said, $19.50. So I said, "Oh, my God, it really made me hot." I said, "Oh, Tony Morelli was right." So I went up and get my money, and he gave me a 10, a 5, 4 ones, and a 50-cent piece. And I put the money in my pocket, and I said, "Mr. Lott," I said, "don't ever book me to wrestle for you again." I said, "You're not but a goddamn thief." "What? What? Oh, here's the tickets I sold." I said, "I don't care." I said, "Just don't book me. I won't ever wrestle for you again." So I went back to the dressing room, got my suitcase, and I was going out the door with a guy named Jack Gott and Tommy Peterson. They were the Tulsa office boys, you know, referee. And Jimmy Lott came up to me, and he said, "You're nothing but a smart aleck little punk kid." Well, you know, I'm 25 years old. I guess I was probably. But I had told him I wouldn't wrestle for him, see. So I sat my suitcase down. He grabbed me by the shirt, pulled out a blackjack, went to hit me in the head with the blackjack. And I hooked his arm and stood on his foot and spun him down and took him down. And I took the blackjack away from him, and I beat him unconscious. Mm. And the guy, Tommy Peterson, said, "Hey, Wicks," he said, "you better get out of here." He said, "He knows the chief of police and the mayor in town." He said, "He's in bad shape." So I you know, I had the rabbit in me. I ran. So anyway, they smuggled me out of town. and to go to Texarkana the next night, and he swore out a warrant for me for assault or murder. And he sent the warrant down to Texarkana because he knew I was going to be down there wrestling. Well, I didn't go to the matches. The guys hid me out in a motel, picked me up after the matches, and we went back to Tulsa. We got back to Tulsa about, I guess, 4 or 5 o'clock that next morning, and I had to go to the office, of course, to see Leroy McGurk. He was a promoter at the time. And Leroy told me, he said, Wicks, he said, I can't use you no more. He said, promoters aren't going to want to use you. You didn't like the payoff, so you beat the shit out of the promoter. Well, I said, he took the blackjack, you know, at me, and I just took it away from him, that's all. I did him in pretty good. Well, he said, that ain't what the other promoters are going to hear. They're going to hear you didn't like the payoff, so you beat the crap out of the promoter. So he says, you're going to have to leave the territory. And I wasn't there a month. So that's when Leroy called Nick Goulas and Roy Welch, and I went into Nashville from there. And then I was starving to death in Nashville, and Buddy Fuller was promoting down there in Mobile, and he heard about me, so he wanted me to come down there. So Goulas sent me down to Fuller, and Fuller liked, you know, my wrestling ability. He heard I could wrestle a little bit, and he said, how about meet me at the YMCA, Wicks? So I said, okay. So he brought down the Fields boys, Bobby and Don, and of course I just ate them up. You know, they weren't nothing. Then, needless to say, he liked me and put the belt on me in Lafayette, Louisiana in October of
58. Heck, you beat him for the title, didn't you?
Yeah, right. See, Fuller liked yep. me. Like, see, he liked guys that could wrestle, Fuller did. He liked Charlie Carr. Remember old Bobby? Remember Charlie
yep.
Carr?
Yes, sir.
Well, he was a fine old gentleman. I tell you. He liked, yep. liked the booze a little bit, but he was a fine old gentleman.
Now, did you, I know you had had some matches with a guy by the name of Pepe Pasquale.
I only think I had one match with Pepe, I think. I don't really remember. I remember he was down there. He had the belt for a while there.
Right. Now, were you there when, because he dropped the belt to the mighty Yankee, who was Reggie Vilmer. Did you work with Vilmer any?
No, I never worked with Vilmer, that I recall. He was down there, I remember that. Ray Vilmer, he was down there. He was a tough old shooter.
Yeah, he was.
Another guy named Speedy LaRance. You remember Speedy
yep.
LaRance?
Yep, Speedy was in and out.
Yeah.
And then you and Yvonne Robert had the world tag team title. I think you beat the Corsicans.
Right, yeah.
Both of them. And I have not been able to find out until he passed away a couple of years ago. I never could find out much about him. I guess he worked besides the Gulf Coast. He worked quite a bit up around Portland and British Columbia.
Right. We were out there for a while. He was a terrific guy. Really, I like him.
I guess your best known opponent was Sputnik.
Well, he was my mentor. In fact, I quit. I walked out on the matches down in Mobile because I was working in Memphis on Monday, Pensacola, Florida, Tuesday, Mobile, Wednesday, Panama City, Florida, Thursday, Gulfport, Mississippi, Friday, Saturday morning, Memphis Television, Saturday night, Jonesboro, Sunday afternoon, Birmingham TV. And back then, they didn't have no expressways at all, of course, you know. My ass was dragging. And I made the decision because I had met a guy in Memphis who was real, you know, concerned about me. Just a real nice fellow named Ray Mathis. And he said, Billy, if you ever decide to quit wrestling, he said, I get you a job at DuPont Chemical Company or a deputy sheriff's job. Well, you know, after a couple of weeks of down the road, 7 nights a week, you're gone all the time, I says, well, I'm ready to go for the deputy sheriff's job. So I went to work for the sheriff's department in November of 60. In my last year of wrestling, I made over $21,000. In my first year at the sheriff's department, I think I made $4,600.
Wow.
Big cut.
You continued to wrestle part-time up until the early 70s, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. See, when I went on the sheriff's department, one of the stipulations was I couldn't wrestle anymore. See, the sheriff didn't want none of his deputies doing any outside work. Well, we got a new sheriff in there, a guy named Bill Morris, and he liked me, and he said, I asked him if I could wrestle in the small towns around there, and he said, yeah, as long as you can conduct yourself okay. And I said, yeah, sure. So I started making a few extra bucks, and of course, Lawler, I met Lawler there. He wrote me a letter and asked me how he could get started, and I invited him out to the police training academy where I was working at the time and got him on the mat. Of course, he couldn't wrestle, but Jerry's a terrific guy. What's good about Jerry, he never boozed, he never fooled any drugs. He's a jam-up guy. He really is. Of course, he don't know nothing about wrestling. But he just signed a contract. He just signed a contract with WWE, 3-year contract for $500,000 a year. That ain't bad.
He was even though he did not have a legitimate wrestling background, he was a great worker.
Oh, one of the best
worked punch I've ever seen.
Yeah,
was probably the one he threw.
Yeah, he really was good. Have you seen that movie Memphis Heat yet?
No, I think it's coming out. I'm finally going to come out on DVD sometime the first part of October, end of September, and I'm going to try and get my hands on a copy of it.
It's hard to
see things like that because it was in a limited release.
Right.
But you were in that movie as well, weren't you?
A bit. Do I?
You were interviewed for that, weren't you? And part of that.
Yeah, I'm in that movie. They interviewed me a few places in there, and I called the promoter Nick Gulas and Roy Wells an asshole.
That's why it's a documentary and not fiction. You were telling the truth.
Right.
You were talking about helping Lawler get started. You also helped Rocket Monroe get in the business, didn't you? The second Rocket Monroe, Barry High.
I used to stretch him a little bit, you know. He used to cry, but he was tough. He said, I'm coming back. And he did. He came back. He wasn't going to be discouraged.
Billy's being kind now. Rocket told me they beat the crap out of him.
Yeah, well, I used to stretch him a little bit. Yeah.
Now, you also helped Rip Tyler get in the business, didn't you, Dean Vaughn?
Yeah, he used to come out and he used to do the same thing. Yeah, old Dean, he's a good old guy. I like Dean. He's dead, you know. Like everybody, I know more dead people than I do live people.
Well, you mentioned Tony Morelli earlier. He just passed away a few months ago. He was 93 years old.
He's been gone longer than that, ain't he?
Was it? No, I don't think so. I think it was him that just passed away. It was, or maybe it was Tony Constanza. It was one or the other of them.
No, it was Tony Morelli. No.
It may have been Constanza then, but he was up there in age. He was in his early 90s when he passed away. That's the reason I was thinking maybe. But Rip talked a great deal about you. I guess you guys met. You wrote him a ticket or something.
Who?
Clark was up there. Rip Tyler, Dean Vaughn.
Yeah.
I
stopped him. That's right. I never wrote him a ticket, though. No. That's how I met him, actually. I stopped him. I think he was on a motorcycle, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think
and
that's right.
I was into motorcycles at that time. And when I stopped and pulled him over, I said, hey, let me take your bike for a ride. So I took his bike for a little spin. in uniform with my partner in the squad car, and I can stop a guy and take his motorcycle away from him. Now, Dean, and then, of course, I invited him. We used to work out. We had a ring set up at Jimbo Stewart's junkyard out on Jackson and Hollywood.
Yeah, that's another name that Rock had mentioned was Jimbo Stewart helping him.
Oh, yeah.
and Big Jim Holly.
Oh, big old Jim Holly. God, now he's dead too, ain't he?
I believe so, yeah.
I'm trying to think.
Tell us a little bit about Greg Peterson.
What?
I mean, you guys do. I said, tell us a little bit about Greg Peterson, because all three of us had the pleasure of working around him, and Jerry and I both wrestled him, and he was smooth as silk. He was so deceptive, because to look at him, you'd never thought he was
Greg was very salty. He was. We met in sixth grade at McKinley School in St. Paul, Minnesota, back when in sixth grade, and we went to Mechanic Arts High School, and we both got on the gymnastic team, and. Anyway, this is how I met him, and we were buddies for years. In fact, I got him down in a mobile. They had opposition, they called it that time, you know, which was actually competition. And Fuller said, "God damn, I wish I knew somebody that the local guys didn't know that could wrestle a little bit." Well, I said, "I got a buddy of mine," I said, Bunyan, I said, "up in Minnesota," I said, "named Greg Peterson." I said, "He's a tough little shot, man. He can go." He said, "Call him on the phone." I called Greg, and 2 days later, he was down in Mobile.
Wow. He was, he worked all over the place. And he, other than Mobile, I don't guess he ever really worked on top anywhere, but they kept him on top for several years in and out of Mobile. And of course, he retired there in Bonifay, and Bobby.
Yeah, never mind. I live on my computer. It's the only thing I get out of bed for in the morning. Like, that's why I give you my email. Anybody got any questions or comments, email me. I can send you some pictures and from the past and stuff like that. So, lost my train of thought. You know how that gets when you get old.
Are you still in pretty good shape?
Oh, I weigh about 185, and I, like I say, I teach a class. The last class I taught was March the 31st. That was over at Johnny Husky's MMA school over in Arden, North Carolina, just south of Asheville, about 10 miles. And so that's the last class I taught. But, I it's just so damn hard for me to get around in my old age.
Well, speaking of old timers, we've got a caller coming in here who we haven't heard from in a couple of weeks. He's our unofficial executive producer. Let me get him on the live list.
Yeah.
Mr. Steinborn, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Poo-poo, Jacob, Tiki Poo-poo, how are you?
Okay, Billy, good to hear from you. Nice to hear your stories, too.
I like to hear it, but God damn it. You're one of the best. I watched your matches. You were one hell of a man in that ring. I see you down there in Mexico. God damn it. You were good. I didn't realize how good you were.
You know, it's funny now. Here I met you. And when I first met you, in Nashville when they had one of those trade shows.
Right.
The minute I saw you, you have no idea how I felt as a fan when I saw you, because I was raised in New York, and the biggest thing that they had was Madison Square Garden, and nothing else in the United States mattered until, at a very early age, I heard that they sold out Mobile, Alabama with Billy Wicks and Sputnik Monroe.
Oh, that was Memphis.
And former world boxing champion Rocky Marciano was supposed to be the referee.
Yeah,
we heard that in the North.
That was in Memphis,
like, Memphis rather. And it's like somebody.
August the 17th, 1959, outdoor match.
Wow. And to hear that in the North saying, what do you mean? Do you mean there's another Madison Square Garden somewhere else in the South? And that was a shock. So when I first met you, it was like shaking hands with her. And tell everybody the story about Rocky Colombo and coming in the dressing room with Rocky Marciano and what he was going to do.
Right. Rocky Colombo was on the card that night and was back in the dressing rooms. And he came over to me. Of course, he was high at that time. You know, nobody fooled with drugs back then, but, you know, it was beer or wine or whatever. And Colombo come over to me and said, "Hey, Wicks, I'm going to make national news." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm going to sucker punch Marciano and knock him out." I said, "What?" "Yeah, I said, just think of the publicity I'll get. He's never been knocked out. I'll tap him on the shoulder and spin around. Bang, I'll take him out." Oh, shit. So I left the dressing room, went out and waited for Marciano to come in, and I told Marciano, I said, "Hey, Rocky," I said, "I'm Billy Wicks," I said, "there's a guy in the dressing room named Rocky Colombo. He wants to sucker punch you, knock you out, get the national day." He said, "God, well, I appreciate it, Wicks, so thank you." So he came in the dressing room, and he didn't take his eyes off of Colombo.
What a classic story. The classic. I'll tell you how goofy I think Colombo was. In Fort Lauderdale at the National Guard Armory, I'm standing out watching the match, and, you know, Colombo was, he really made some impressive moves in the ring. He went through the second and third rope and did a flip through the air and landed on the floor. And I really thought he was hurt. You know, I'm one of the boys. I run down the ringside, and it's got about 600-700 people in there. And as I lean over to him and say, "Are you all right?" He sits up like nothing went on in a sitting position, and he says, "Get out of here. I work here." And he went back, he laid right back down in the same position.
Yeah.
And I felt like a fool. That's a true story.
Let me tell you a story, too. Down in Dallas, Texas, the Sportatorium. And I'm on the card, and Tiny Mills is one of my buddies from Minnesota, Alan Tiny Mills.
Right.
And I'm watching the matches now, and Tiny's coming back from the ring after his match. And all of a sudden, a spectator jumps up and clobbers him. Man, and I run down there to get involved. I said, "God damn, Tiny's my buddy." So, man, I run down there, and the cops grab me, and they said, "Hold it, Wicks." Then I realized that they're working the goddamn program. They ain't told me nothing about it, so I get back in the dressing room, and Tiny Mills is there, and all the other boys, and Bastien was on the car, and Bastien comes in the dressing room. He says, "It's all right, boys." He said, "I just called Wally Carville, and it's all right to smarten Billy up." And his brother Al was sitting there. Al Mills says, "That's okay, Billy." He said, "We need more boys like you to take care of each other, you know."
You couldn't lose or you couldn't win with both parts you played. Oh, Lord. Too much.
I miss seeing you, Dickie Poo, and our little get-togethers down in Mobile.
Yeah.
I hear Don is in a wheelchair. I talked to Bill Bowman the other night, and he said Don Fargo's in a wheelchair.
Yeah, you're right. In fact, I talked to him about last week, and he said he was in a wheelchair. And then they're having a reunion in Nashville this Friday, tomorrow night, and Saturday. And I think Scott Teal has got somebody to come down, drive down from Nashville down into Canton, wherever he lives. He's going to pick up Fargo and drag him all the way back up to Nashville and give him some awards or something.
Terrific, terrific.
So, yeah.
I talked to
Bockwinkel
the night.
Beg your pardon?
I talked to Bockwinkel a couple nights ago.
How is he doing?
He seems to be doing all right. I had heard he had a little Alzheimer's, and you know, but I didn't sense any of that. I called him, and he knew who I was and everything. We talked, I guess, 15 minutes or so. Talked about Red. You know, Red's up in Minnetonka, Minnesota, in a nursing home, and he's got Alzheimer's pretty good right now, I understand.
Yeah, you gave me the number, and I did call him. And his roommate got on the phone, and he says, I said, let me speak to Red Bastien. And he puts Red on. And Red says, hello. And I says, hey, Red, this is Dick Steinborn. And you know what he says?
What?
Yeah, I remember him.
Uh-oh.
And the minute he said that, you know, you back off. And I says, hey, I love you, Red. And I just hung the phone up. And
yeah.
What else can you do?
Now, his wife was very, Carol, she was very protective of him. She didn't want nobody bothering.
Yeah.
And I gave his number. I think I gave his number to you, didn't I?
Yes, I called him.
And I gave his number to Pat Barrett, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Bockwinkel, if he doesn't have Alzheimer's, does he have, I think they call it dementia. That's the beginning of it. Dementia,
yeah, right.
Is you go in and out of it, and Alzheimer's is when you go into it, it stays too long. And then you
come
out of it.
Yeah, he's got dementia, what he is, yeah.
Did he mention that he had it, or he knew it, or?
No, he didn't. You want his number?
Heck yes.
Wait a minute. Okay.
How old is Bockwinkel?
60. How old is he?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's about 76, I think. Bockwinkel. The number I have is 702.
655-8892. And all the people listening to our program, they start calling Bockwinkel. You're going to have to take the email.
Don't forget to call or email me. I'll email Willie Vicks, bellsouth.net.
Hey, let me tell you something that's funny. Down in Mobile, when we had that reunion years ago, and Billy showed up, we've all been trying to get Ken Lucas to show up. He doesn't show up.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I remember that.
So Ken Lucas is over in the apartment someplace on the beach.
We drove over to Pensacola, remember?
Right, so after the reunion, and you've been friends with him for years, you've known him for years, and of course your body has changed. Your hair has curly blonde hair is gone.
Yeah, right.
So after the reunion, we put on a skit there, I remember, for Lee Fields. We drove over to his place, and I had told him I would come by after the reunion and talk to him. So we show up in the apartment, and there he is sitting in the chair, Kenny Lucas. And I introduce Billy Wicks as Willie Bicks. We just changed it around to Willie Bicks because Billy told me to do this in the car. And he shook his head. He shook his hand and he said, oh, nice to see you. Good to see you. How was the reunion? And he's looking at me now. He's not looking at Billy anymore. And he's known Billy for years. And now he's a different personality. And the name should resolve somewhere in his brain. And he looks over at Billy and says, what territory you ever work in? And he says, Portland. By that time, you grabbed him in a headlock. And you had him hooked, and you started shooting with him, and he's screaming. I said, may I introduce you to Billy Wicks?
Hey, I'll give you a couple of phone numbers. You want Frankie Kane's phone number?
Yes, because last one I had, it was disconnected.
Right. This is his cell phone. You ready?
Right.
850-225. 8284.
Okay.
Did you know an old carny wrestler named Dick Cardinal?
Who?
Dick Cardinal.
Oh, yes, Cardinal.
Yeah, I got his phone number. You want it?
God, yes.
360-656. 5437. He'd love to hear from you.
It's Nick, right?
Dick Cardinal.
Dick Cardinal. How old is he now? Good Lord.
86, I think.
Where does he live?
He lives in Ferndale, Washington.
Wow. Do you talk to Tito Carrion much often?
No, I haven't talked to Tito since I saw him at the reunion out there in Portland, or in Seattle.
Yeah, you and I went.
Yeah, I remember meeting you at the airport down there, and you brought me a little, or did I bring you a little wine? We had a little good wine.
Oh, Lord. Well, what else is going on, Billy?
Well, like I said, I'm involved with this Johnny Husky kid. He's, like I said, we got four women fighters now that signed up with him. One of them is a girl that won a silver medal in the Olympics. And he's training them to be MMA fighters.
What'd she win the silver for?
Do what?
In the Olympics. What did she win the silver for in the Olympics?
Wrestling?
I never
got her name. He's supposed to be coming over to see me this weekend. And
they got women wrestling in the Olympics?
Yeah, they got women in the Olympics now.
Good Lord.
It just started in 04, I think it was.
Do you know, when I was in Florida in 1951 or 1952, Terry Majors came down there with her girlfriend, Carol Carrata. And these two girls wrestled in Columbus, Ohio, and they went to a gymnasium, and the gym was run by a semi-pro wrestler who was a policeman who taught them amateur and shooting moves. These two girls. Oh, they came down to Florida and put on exhibitions. You would not believe these girls. They look just like you. But you would watch the amateurs right now on TV, but moving faster, just kind of loose and moving faster, and the beautiful moves and so forth. I was so enthralled. I started, it reminded me of some of the moves I did and so forth. And then I swear to you, one night, Monday night, Terry Majors comes up to me and says, "Dickie," she says, "I saw some of your moves. Would you mind showing Carol and I on this coming Saturday night in Daytona? We'll meet you at the gym at the auditorium where the matches were at 3 o'clock. I got in the ring with these two girls and showed them some of my amateur moves that have turned into pro. They started to show me some of theirs. And then Jesse James stepped in the picture, and he took my girlfriend away from me, and he married her."
Oh, Joe Jesse James, got it. Oh,
he married Terry Majors. And another wrestler by the name of Kowalski married Carol Carrata. Carol Carrata was a great wrestler. These two girls were just above class. The other ones were showman girls. You know, they did the bumps and so forth. But these two girls imitated the men at that time. Yeah.
I remember watching you, Dick. You were a man. You were a hell of a work in that ring. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to explain it to everybody. Billy had never seen me wrestle. I was just a name. I was just another guy. So I think he saw some film of me wrestling in Puerto Rico or something.
Right.
Well, Billy, I'll be very honest with you. That was one of my bad matches.
Oh, man, they were good. I don't think you ever had a bad match, personally.
Who was the best girl workers you guys saw?
The best who?
Girl worker.
Oh,
well, I
maybe Penny Banner.
Yeah, Penny Banner was good. Lorraine Johnson was good.
Lorraine Johnson and Betty Jo Hawkins.
Kay Noble was the best one I ever saw.
Who?
Kay was
Noble.
Good, yes. Oh, yes. Kay was a little bit more modern. Kay was sharper, had a better looking physique, a little bit more modern, to the point. You know who was the potato king on the crowbar of all the girl wrestlers?
Moolah.
No. Mae Young.
Oh, yeah, right. That's right. Right, Rob.
Johnny
Mae
Young.
Yeah, I worked. Me and Gloria Bartini worked against Mae Young and John Smith on a floating ring down there in Pensacola someplace, or Crestview. on a floating ring, and we said, and I said to Gloria, I said, let's get John and throw him in the water. Shit, we couldn't get that number to hand off those ropes. They're going to drown me, Wicks.
Hey, I refereed a match one night in Daytona Beach between Terry Majors and Johnny May Young, and they were shooting. It was unbelievable. And that Johnny May Young was throwing those potatoes. I mean, she was beating the hell out of Terry. And Terry had, you know, Terry was going to win in 10 minutes. I counted 1, 2, 3, and I raised a hand up. I swear to God, Terry pointed to the boys' dressing room and said to Johnny May Young, the boys' dressing room is that way. True story.
Ah, terrific. Terrific.
Sputnik told a story about May, said he was in Memphis and he had bought a pair of cowboy boots. And he said he was in a dressing room, said nobody was in there, he was in there by himself, and he said he had stripped down and he didn't have anything on except those cowboy boots. And he said May come in the door and he said he reached over and he grabbed a towel and he threw it around himself. And said she walked over and grabbed the towel and snatched it off of him. She said, I'm just one of the boys.
Yeah. Now that sounds like her. That's her.
I was in Raleigh, North Carolina at the early age of 24 years of age, and I was in the dressing room, and I was in the same position. I was didn't have any clothes on, and I had the towel in my hand, and she came in the dressing room, and I pulled it. I swear, barely the same thing. I pulled the towel up, and you know what she said to me? She said, I don't want to see what all those young girls want to look at.
Hey, Dick, shoot me an email when you get a chance. I don't have your email address anymore.
Well, I have shut down my computer. I have...
Really?
The main reason I had shut it down was I got too many other things to do. And the last thing I did was I had a MySpace page, and I did a lot of pictures and a lot of stories. And I was told by Scott Teal to do that because it would indicate how anybody would like to read my book, and these are all little excerpts.
Yeah, right.
I had over 200 people wanting to come in.
Wow.
And I accepted them in. So now I'm now backed out. I'm working on a play, and I've got so many things on my mind.
Have you got your book out?
I got about 400 pages already, but, you know, I want to print it, but I swear to you, once you print it, 6 months later, you say to yourself, why didn't I put that story in? And I'm at that stage right now.
Wow.
It goes into about, when you put out a good book, it says 3 to 4 years, which means you're interested for about 4 or 5 months, and then you're not interested. But you got to wait, because you're going to be interested again. You'll let yourself know when you're finished with your book.
You got 400 pages, I guess so.
Well, Scott Teal has got a questionnaire. It's about 11 pages. And once you read, you don't even have to write your story. All you got to do is read these questionnaires that he has, and you'll answer the questionnaires, and he can take a book out of it. He can make a 250-page book out of it just by those questions. And the questions are so obvious. Who did you love on TV, good guy and the bad guy, and why? Well, then you have to explain. I mean, he ties that into, he's good at that, doing all this publication all these years.
Yeah.
So before he ever sent me that, I had 200 pages of my own stories already.
Huh.
The hitchhiker going from. Did you work for Tulsa, for Leroy McGurk?
Yeah, that's where I was there for just a month, and I got in a fight with Lott, you know.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And then Leroy said, you got to leave.
Jimmy Lott.
Nobody wants to use you.
Yeah, he was the promoter in Joplin, Missouri, and he was a very strange promoter. He came in the dressing room and he said to me, he says, look, he says, you're new here, and he says, I want you to go on third. He says, because I want you to watch the first match and the second match, and this will tell you what my fans want. Well, I watched the first match and the second match, and there was no way I was going to repeat what these guys were doing. It was ridiculous.
Oh, it wasn't no wrestling at all then, I guess.
No, he had lost his touch already.
Huh.
What's the problem you had with him?
Huh?
What's the problem you had with Jimmy Jimmy Lott?
Payoff. Tony Morelli told me he was stealing from the boys. And I met work for him, and I made $20. And the following week was a Christmas night, and he ran a Christmas show, and made $19.50. And I just cussed him out and said, "Hey, don't ever book me a wrestler." I said, "You got." Well, he came after me with a blackjack, and I took it away from him, and I beat the shit out of him. And see, and he swore out a warrant for me, assault to murder. And Leroy said, "I can't use you anymore, Wick." He said, "All the promoters are going to hear that you didn't like the payoff, so you beat the shit out of promoters." So that's why he called Goulis and Welsh and had me going to Nashville.
They sent you to Nashville to beat the hell out of Dick Goulis.
Now, I wish I would have. That's a big no. I'll tell you who was a real prick. Was Roy Welsh.
What's your language?
Yeah, the story was Roy was always the true heel. He just used Goulis as the hatchet man. I mean, when somebody would finally get to Roy, he'd play good cop and, you know, go against what he'd set up to begin with.
Right.
I think I told the story, but let me tell that one more time. I went in there in 1954 with my young wife. Stayed at the Dickerson Trailer Park.
Yeah.
And I go down to Birmingham, and I get to wrestling, and I really got over with Sonny Myers and a nice 20-minute draw. And I got upstairs, and I got paid $40. That was fantastic. And I said, "This is terrific. Thank you, Nick." He said, "Let me tell you something, boy." He says, "I got plans for you." He says, "I'm going to pay you more money next week." God, I couldn't wait to go home and tell my wife. I'm going to pay more money in Birmingham. And she was a young bride, and I was a young wrestler at the time. Next week I go back to Birmingham. I'm expecting, you know, $55, $60.
Right.
He pays me. I go out there, disqualification, Matt, whatever. Come back, he gives me $40. And I said, "Nick, I said, you promised me more money." That's how naive I was for this promoter.
Yeah.
To be treating a wrestler who's the son of a wrestler who grew up in New York and went to dressing rooms and knew the pro ranks, and I'm in Nashville, I'm in the rectum of the United States in the annal, which is Nick Goulis' territory, and that night in Birmingham, and I says to him, "You told me you're going to make more money. Let me tell you something, boy, when you get in the main event, I'll pay you more money." Well, it dawned on me right there. He's the one that's going to put me in the main event.
Wait,
I said to myself, I have to leave the territory. So I called my dad and I told him. And he says, he told me what to tell Nick. So I called the wrestling office and I told Nina, who was the secretary. I said, "Nina," I said, "I need to give you my notice." "Well, you're going to give your notice for 2 weeks?" He says, "No, I'm leaving this Saturday night." She says, "Why?" I said, "It's an emergency." She says, "What's wrong?" I says, "My boxer dog is having puppies in Florida, and I must be there."
All right. Hey, Dickie, when you see this movie, Memphis Heat, you listen to what Jerry Jarrett says about, what he says about Nick Goulis. Jerry Jarrett talking about the promotion in Nashville and what he says about Goulis.
Really?
Yeah. He said, well, I'll tell you what he said. He said, "I'd seen," now this is Jerry Jarrett talking. He said, "I seen Goulis put out the payoffs, all the boys, and then go around and take like $10 away from each buy off." And Jerry said, "Well, Nick," he said, "it cost us almost $50 to get the shots." He said, "Well, they ought to draw it better." Jerry says that on this film.
Did you see the film?
Yeah, they sent me a copy of it. I got a copy of it right here.
Is my part in there?
I don't think so, Dick.
Okay, I'm in another one with Gorgeous George.
No. This was put out by some local guys in Memphis.
I see.
And they interviewed Dick Billy for that same Vince's sent a crew to his house to interview him about Gorgeous George, just like they did with you.
Yeah, well, Dickie Steinborn is the guy that got me hooked up for that. I blame him for getting that $1,500.
I sent him to see Jackie Fargo, too. He got the same thing.
Hey, there's a first-class prick. You see him in that movie talking about, he says, if I couldn't beat Sputnik Monroe, I'd quit wrestling.
That's what Jackie said?
Yeah.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, you see, like I said, you see that movie, you get that movie, Memphis Heat, I guarantee you, you listen to that bragging son of a bitch. when the WWE people come here to interview me, the guys from Memphis, they were going to see Jackie Fargo, too. And I said, he just lives a couple hundred miles down the road. Tell him to come and see me. Come by my house and you get us both at the same time. But Fargo wouldn't do it.
Really?
That's the night that Jerry Lawler and Jim White and Mario Galindo all got arrested down in Batesville, Mississippi.
For what?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I went by the TV station to see Roy when I was working at the Sheriff's Department in Memphis. And I'd been on about, 4 years. And I needed some money, so I went to see Roy at the TV station. I said, Roy, how about booking me once in a while in these small towns? Well, he said, Jerry's got the book. You have to see him. Wait a minute, Brent. What you ought to do? He said, he's out in the ring now, he said, working with Lawler. You ought to go out there and just jump in the ring and kick the shit out of him. He said, he needs a good ass kicking. I said, why in the hell would I do that to Jarrett, man? He's a baby face, and I'm a baby. Why would I? Well, maybe you can work a deal or something. And I said, that sounds crappy. Well, the following week, I'm home watching TV from Memphis. And all of a sudden, I see Mario Galindo go to get in the ring. Lawler and Jarrett are working. And all of a sudden, here comes Jackie Fargo and Ojo Yamamoto. And Fargo's got a sawed-off baseball bat, and he starts beating the shit out of Mario's head, busting him open. And I'm saying to myself, hey, this is for real. For real. And I thought to myself, well, Roy set this shit up. He told Mario to go into the ring and work a program with Jerry Jarrett. Ooh, Mario Galindo, he's dumb. He goes in there. Then he goes tells Fargo and Tojo, Galindo's going to jump in the ring, kick the shit out of him.
Oh, jeez.
So that happened. Well, about 2 weeks later, Mario has a heart attack. He's in the VA hospital, and I go see him. And he wants to give me his trunks and his shoes and all that kind of stuff. He ain't going to. I said, no, Mario. I said, you'll be back. Well, he came back all right. He got in shape, and he called me, and he said, Wick, you working tonight? And you know, Blyville or Jackson? He said, well, if you see Fargo or Tojo or Lawler, tell them I'm coming to see them. Well, I was in Blytheville, and I told Fargo, I said, hey, Jackie, I said, Mario, he said he's coming to see you. That son of a bitch, you know, he just, maybe I'll kill him, blah, 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 blah. Well, Red Dunn was working booking Batesville, Mississippi, and I was on the card down there, and I was against Jerry Lawler and Jim White. And I forget who else was on the card. I've worked the first match, and I'm back in the dressing room, and here comes the referee. He said, hey, Wicks, Mario Galindo's in the ring. He's challenging Lawler to come on out of the dressing room. Well, I said, I better go out there and straighten it up. So I go out in the ring. I said, hey, Mario, come on. I said, you're killing the show. Tell Lawler to get out here. I want to whip him. And I said, hey, get out of here. You're screwing the thing up now. Well, Galindo gets out of the ring. He goes back to the dressing room where Lawler and White's at. But Jim White always carried a gun in his suitcase. And he thought, when Galenta opened the door, Jim White pulled the gun, and the deputy sheriff was standing there, and he arrested all of them. And they all went to jail.
No.
Lawler and Jim White and Galenta.
No,
well, I
kidding.
Got home at night, and that killed the show. We had to give the money back and everything. we only had one match. And then the main
question, did you get paid?
No, like I said, Red Donovan was my buddy, you know, and my daughter, Debbie, was selling the tickets.
Billy,
well,
you gotta write a book, Billy.
Oh, no. But anyway, well, I got into it with Fargo. I got home about 12:30 that night, the morning. Fargo called me, Jackie Fargo called me. Hey, Wich, what went on down there in Batesville tonight? Well, I said, told you, like, Glento came down there to get Lawler. Well, why didn't you kick the shit out of him? I said, I have no squabble with Glento. I said, damn up guy, as far as I'm concerned. Well, you always kick the shit out of him. I said, wait a minute. You're the one that beat the hell out of him with a giant baseball bat. I said, I think he was looking for your ass. Well, I'll tell you what, you won't get any bookings anymore. Boy, I cussed him out and hung up.
Oh, you're telling the other side of Jackie Fargo?
What?
You're telling the other side of Jackie Fargo.
I know him
as another way.
That's Jackie Fargo, the guy I'm just talking about.
That's what I thought about, which means we're talking about the 80s or the 70s.
What do you mean?
What years was that?
Oh, that was early 70s, yeah, early
70s. Early 70s.
Yeah, 73, 74, somewhere in there.
I wonder if he's changed over the years.
Well, you'll see him on that film. He looks like death, eating a banana.
Guys, I've got another guest I'm going to get on here with us who is currently a promoter out of Kingsport and works in East Tennessee area, and he's been around the business for about 23 years now and is trying to keep up the tradition of what you guys did back in your day and everything. And he's one of the few that is doing that. And you guys, I would love for you guys to stay on the line with us because I'm sure Paul would love to talk to you guys as well, but let me try and get Mo James on the line with us here real quick. Bear with me, I'm still trying to learn all this new technology.
Good talking with you, Dickie boy.
Same here.
Did you guys just accept all this heat giving these phone numbers out? I don't want Frank the King.
Our ratings will go up next week.
I'll take the credit for it.
You got it, Billy. It's all yours. Who are you calling?
Who?
Hey, Bo, this is Michael Norris with P-State Pandemonium. Also got Bobby Simmons, Jerry Oates, Billy Wicks, and Dick Steinborn on the line with us.
Well, it's a full house tonight, then.
This is Bo James, the current king of Kingsport. He runs a promotion out of Kingsport, East Tennessee, called Southern States Wrestling, and Bo is old school to his heart. If you hear him talk, you see him work, you think that Charlie Carr trained him. That's how old school he is.
That's why all these younger guys hate my guts, too. So,
please
nobody get my number out. I get enough people calling and emailing to kill me, so please no one get my number out on air.
Well, give it to me. I'll put it out.
Bo has also just recently published a book. You guys were talking about books. Bo has just put one out himself. First of all, Bo, give us a little bit of your background. Tell us how you got in the business and what interested you in pro wrestling. I'm assuming you like the rest of it. You were a fan.
Yeah, I grew up. I had I had two cousins that worked for Nick Goulas and for Jim Crockett, Zach Murray and Melvin Johnson. They worked in the 60s and 70s, and probably, I think Zach lasted about 82 or 83. And I just grew up a big fan. The Knoxville office ran Johnson City every Tuesday night, and Crockett ran Kingsport every other Sunday. So I went to the matches six times a month growing up as a kid. I always wanted to be in the business. I always dreamed of getting started. And how I actually got started in the wrestling business was my mother was in management with Walmart when they first came here to East Tennessee, and she started booking the wrestlers in the grand openings of the Walmarts, and I got to meet Tommy, Johnny, and Davy Rich through that, and I just got to know them. I was 14 years old, and they helped me get in. Davy Rich told Ron West, he said, "Hey, Ronnie, find something for this kid to do. He loves our business, and he's always around." And Ron West gave me a job of putting a ring up and selling merchandise while the matches went on, and I never would imagine that 23 years later I'd still be doing it.
God, dog. it bit you, the wrestling bug bit you, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. There's nothing worse. You can't get away from it. I told somebody that the other day. You know, you're either in or you're out, and when you leave, you got to get so far out you can't even find yourself.
Well, yep. Anything you permit, you promote, you know.
Yeah. So, Mr. Wicks, are you still in the Waynesville area?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You're only about 80 or 90 miles away from me.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I dedicated my body when I die to the, wait a minute, I got it here in a minute.
You having a senior moment again?
Yeah, no, I was looking for I dedicated my body to the Quinlan College of Medicine over there in Johnson City.
Yes.
Yeah, I've donated my body. I got a tag here, and I told my roommate, she said, what am I going to do with you when you die? Well, I said, you just call Quinlan College of Medicine. Here's the number right here on this little tag, 866-968-3668. Just call it. You got a cadaver.
Wait a minute. Let me get that number. That number again.
Yeah. I live about 12 miles from the hospital there.
Well, I dedicated my body. See, so one of these days I'm going to be the main event for the next anatomy. and when they cut me open, they said, hey, look at this guy's got a battery in his chest. He's got a knee. And he's got six screws and a plate in his neck. Boy, this is cool.
He's got cauliflower ears.
Oh, yeah, and they got the little flowers in the ears.
Well, let me tell you something, young man. The way you talk and the way you've gone through what you've gone through is just like what I've gone through when I seen my dad wrestle and watched all the. That's in your blood now. See, that stays.
Yeah, yeah. I've already got two nephews that are already in the ring. They're teenage boys. They've already started.
Wow.
You know, and as you grow older, you may come to an age where for 6 or 7 or 8 years, you don't have anything to do with wrestling. And all of a sudden, you get to a certain age, over 50 years of age, and you want to rehash your past, and that's when it starts to come back again. And that's when you have better ideas for whoever is underneath you, probably your sons or whoever.
Yeah.
It's a love.
The only problem with that, by the time I'm probably 50 years old, the way the business has become over here, there's not going to be anything left of it.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah. Well, maybe you're not, you didn't hear me say this once before, but I'll say it again now. How old are you right now?
37.
In 20 years from now, 37, 57, let's say 30 years from now, 67. When you're 67 years of age and you're watching television, they're going to have a wrestling show on. It's going to be so outlandish and so weird and so far out there. You're going to say, God, what happened to the matches back in 2011?
The guys will come to the ring with rockets on their back.
I don't have any problem with the rockets on their back. The problem I have with is they don't wear wrestling gear. you find other than the two or three little promotions here in the southeast, it's hard to go and find a pair of wrestling boots in the dressing rooms.
Yeah,
really? Do you boys wear wrestling gear?
Oh yes, talent? Or they don't get in the ring. They're not allowed. There's a sign everywhere I go, and I talk about this in the book. When I started at the end of the territories, I worked for Jerry Jarrett. And of course, I was around Ronnie West and Bob Pope when I first started selling merchandise for him. Ronnie West taught me how to hustle merchandise when I was 13, 14 years old. I tell these guys now, I said, I was making more money at 14 years old selling merchandise than you guys are in main events. Because they don't care to learn anything about it. They don't. It's just, and it's sad because Kingsport, right here, our hometown, it ran every Wednesday night for 43 years.
Yeah.
You ask most of the guys here about it, and they have no clue. Y'all were talking about Greg Peterson earlier. He had a huge run here, summer of 67, as Whitey Caldwell's partner.
Yeah.
And he worked with Ron and Don Wright here in Kingsport, John City, in Mickey Barnes' little territory.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's nobody. I told Michael I listen to this every week, and not just for the stories, but I listen to this program every week just to hear the boys speak to each other.
Yeah.
Because there's no boys left. You sit in the dressing room now. When I started, like I said, it was grown men trying to make a living or trying to better themselves and better their families. Now it's a bunch of young kids, and not in my dressing room, and Tony Givens has got another good promotion here. But, you know, a few weeks ago I was in West Virginia. My wife works, and she's been wrestling for almost 5 years. We're sitting in the dressing room, and here comes this guy with his whole family, his mother, sisters, I mean, everybody that have no business in there. So when I speak up and say something about it, you know, they don't want to bring me back.
Yeah.
They tell me I'm an asshole and my ways are too old and I better get with the times.
Here's the problem with the promotions today, because I promoted for a while. Promotions now, the guys promoting, they don't know the wrestling game. That's the problem.
That's
they know
right.
Nothing about it. They
and
know
they've,
nothing
they've
about
never
it.
Made a living at it. They've never made a dime in it, so they don't believe that anybody can. Here I am 23 years after that day that Davey Rich told Ron West give his kid a job. It's still the only job I've ever had. You know, we still make a living doing it, and there's very few of us out there that still do. And the reason being is they've whored and raped the business so bad, they've just killed it.
You're correct.
You know,
how many
and
towns you
just,
run a week?
Well, now we run three towns a month, but I do probably 12 to 16 towns a month working for other people. You know, but just 10 years ago, I ran Thursday, Friday, Saturday. You know, we had a good little thing here. We've got TV here. We've had, you know, but it's just here. I started promoting my own town. I promoted towns for Ron West when I was a kid. And then when Continental went out, my family and I, we started running our own little towns here. And I could take a guy like Ivan Koloff off of Crockett's TV and draw 500 to 1,000 people in the towns with him. Now you take anybody that's off New York TV, and you, other than a select few, you're not going to draw over 100 people.
There you go.
Because they don't know. People will talk about it. Where I grew up, they will talk about Ron and Don Wright. That's the first thing off their lips. Whitey Caldwell. You know, the Mongolian Stomper, Bob Armstrong. But I couldn't tell you a New York star if he came to my house right now. I wouldn't know who he was.
I wouldn't either.
And the problem is all these guys now, where and I tell them, I say, don't try to be that guy that's on TV because they've already got him. Try to be yourself and learn your history, because you got to know where you're coming from to know where you're going to.
That's right.
And it's just the I cannot imagine. Jimmy Valiant, he's around here. He don't live far from us, and he still makes towns. He started in 1964. I cannot imagine what goes through his mind sitting in the dressing room looking at some of these guys, some of these places.
Yeah,
I started in 88, and I can't believe the changes I've seen since 1988. And really about 2000, 2001, that's really when you saw the changes, because all these fly-by-night play wrestlers started opening up wrestling schools, and then their buddy would get mad because he couldn't be the champion, so he'd go buy a ring and set up across town. Newport, Tennessee, my cousin ran Newport last week, and I told him, I said, Josh, don't run that town because it's not going to do any business. And he went and ran it anyways, and it didn't do any business. But the same night we're at the Armory, there was two other promoters running free shows, letting the people in for free.
I'm going to have to cut off for a minute. I'll come right back.
Okay. All right, Billy, come on. Let me tell you one thing, young man. It's very good to hear your conversation. We as elders and legends in the business, we really don't know what's going on. You mean to tell me there's three promotions in one town that you...
Within 12 miles of where I live. I'm 12 miles to Kingsport. I'm 12 miles to Johnson City. I'm 24 miles to Bristol. There's seven promotions.
Let me ask you this. I used to promote myself, too. Now, I'm looking at you like a chess player. I'm looking at you and your territory and your experience and so forth. There needs to be a change. Now, what could the change be?
Well,
in other words,
you're
all competing against the same thing. Somebody needs to change something.
Well,
I'm
going to
throw
but
something
see,
at you.
Hey, wait a minute. Now you sound like Obama.
Well, if I get Congress behind me to vote on this, let me just say I heard of one thing down in Puerto Rico. They had an opposition down in Puerto Rico. You know what they did? Every wrestler had a suit on, complete suit, including a mask. And in between the mask, of course, it costs money to do this, they had some kind of material that lit up. And over the ring, they had the lights coming down over the ring. And when you turn the lights out in the arena and the matches went on, these guys were underneath this blue light, and they were making these unbelievable moves, going up and down with the hip lock and the drop kick. But it was like like if you take movie film and it skips, that's what it looked like. And because of their material they had in their the strips of metallic in between the material as he went, but as it caught the light, it was like slow motion in the ring. One of the wrestlers told me that was done in Mexico. Now, that was a change. Now, what can be a change if you book something? If you book something, what should it be on the poster that says that it's so different than tonight's matches? Five black wrestlers against five wrestlers, white wrestlers. First match, a black versus a white. Second match, a black versus a white. Same thing, third, fourth, and fifth match. Something different.
Yeah. Here's the thing. We're talking about trying to draw money. We're trying to do something different to draw. You got to realize now, 99% of these guys don't care if they get paid a nickel.
That's the problem.
They just want to do it. It's a hobby, and that's like I tell them every week. I say, if you want a hobby, go join a bowling team.
Don't you have a booker?
Go join a softball team.
Don't you have a booker?
Yeah, I have my little crew. I'm not talking about my crew. I'm talking about everywhere else around here, and not just here. I've wrestled all the way up to Portland and Seattle. That is the state. It's playtime. That is what the state of the dressing room has become.
I see.
You know, they don't care if you pay them because they're not worth paying. Who let them in? That's the first thing. Years ago, I used to tell guys, we got to break their bones, and everybody turned on me. Every week, somebody comes up to me and goes, man, you were right. Look what has happened. You know, And it's just,
well, how do you think they should be changed? How do you think?
Well, some well-planned murders. That's really that's the only way. Because until somebody walks up and shoots somebody in the head and says you're not going to run a town again, they're going to keep going. And for every promotion that starts now, by this time next year, there'd be two, maybe three, in the same town. The same town. Because they get mad. He threw my wife out of the building. He yelled at my mother. And I'm telling you, I never thought I would ever get to the days of where you would have to deal with a wrestler's mother or his wife and girlfriend. And they have more fight in them than the actual wrestlers do.
How is your talent compared to everybody else's? That's the key.
They're a lot better because I do a training camp here at my house in my backyard about every 5 years, and I spend every day of that summer with a handpicked few guys in the ring with them, and I teach them the old ways. And it's so surprised, like you knew. Years ago, you knew, everywhere there was a few guys that was like pulling teeth with or whatever. Now, you can't find a guy to have a match with. 90% of the places that call me or my wife, we just tell them, hey, we'll bring a guy and a girl to work with. Just because wrestling now is like a blind date. You have no idea what you're getting until you get in the ring with them.
That's right. Okay. Hey, I'm going to have to beg off. I got some body functions I got to take care of.
All right, Billy.
All right, good talk.
I'm going to email you, Mr. Wicks. I'm going to come find you over there in Waynesville. That's not far from me. I'm going to come see you.
Do it. Willie Bix at bellsouth.net.
I've got it. I'm going to email you as soon as we get done here.
All right, thanks. Good talking
to you. Thank you. Yes.
Take care, Dickie Poo.
Yeah, man.
Thanks, Billy. We appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Well, let me ask you one thing. Who books these matches?
Whoever rents the building and rents the ring that day.
Oh.
There's nobody to stop anybody from running. There's no governing body. In the state of Virginia, there's a commission. But if you pay your fee, they won't do anything to you. There's 5,000 licensed competitors in the state of Virginia.
Gee whiz. Well, let me.
7,000. Over 7,000 in the state of Kentucky.
When I promoted in Georgia, you had to have a license, you had to have insurance, and you had to have. Don't these people have insurance?
No, they don't have. There's no governing body asking them for it.
Somebody in your there's your answer. Somebody like you needs to get a friend of yours.
I have wrote the governor of Tennessee. I went to the state representatives. They don't want to fool with it because they just look at it as nonsense. On any Saturday night. Actually, any day of the week, from where I'm standing in my house right now, there is a wrestling show going on somewhere. And Saturday, there's 6 or 7 right here in the Tri-Cities. Every weekend.
How many people are there in these places?
Anywhere from 5 or 6 to 300, 400.
Gee whiz.
Now, let's go to Knoxville, which is a bigger city. It's even worse. Now go to Nashville, it's even worse. And that's just right here. I'm not even putting in West Virginia. I don't know why they even try in some of these places. And they're spending huge amounts of dollars. And I tell them, just set it on fire and flush it down the commode because it'll get done faster. But the problem is, it's just right here in Bluefield, a guy called me and said, hey, I got TV, because we've had TV here for almost 15 years now. And I do it part of the time. Tony Gibbons does it part of the time. Sometimes we both have a program on. But the guy from Bluefield called, said, they want to come in. And I took some of my guys up there. So first time we went, there were 7 of us went up there. Next time they told me to bring 4. Then it got down to just me and my wife. Reason being, they didn't want to have to pay my guys because they had a long list of people that would get in the ring for free.
Gee whiz.
And they think they're professional wrestlers.
Well, here's the thing with it today. Anybody can get in the business now. Dickie Steinborn was my brother-in-law. And I was living in Columbus, and he's up from Orlando. And I said, I want to get in the wrestling business. You know, I said, I want to start wrestling. He said, well, that's fine and good. But he said, how's that going to work with you in Columbus and me in Orlando? Well, 3 months later, I was in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
So here he is, a name that everybody knew in the wrestling game, right? So I got down there and got settled, and I said, I'm ready to start working out. You know what he told me? Dickie probably don't even remember. He said, I'll let you know when I'm ready. And I never mentioned it. I think Dickie wanted to see if I really wanted to do it. I respect him for that. And I would say, God, I done packed up and moved down here. And so one Sunday afternoon, he says, let's go work out. And then it started. And it was probably 6 months after I moved down there. And I never mentioned it to him again until he said, I'll let you know when I'm ready. And that's how it went.
The guy, though, he wouldn't go 50 miles. That's the truth.
I moved 400 miles.
Yeah, I moved 4 different times to Nashville, Memphis to go down there for them wonderful payoffs and live there in a wrestling hotel. But, you know, I did it because I wanted to be a wrestler. I didn't want to be anything else. I wanted to be a professional wrestler, and that's why I did it. But you tell a guy now, say, I got you booked. And he goes, oh, great, where? I said, well, you know, Knoxville. That's 100 miles. He won't go. He says, why don't we go there? There's wrestling here.
Well, there's no more respect for it. That's the whole thing.
None whatsoever.
I'm talking about even the guys doing it. There's no respect for it.
No.
Right.
No, not at all.
Vince McMahon has no respect for it. So, you know, I just,
it bothers me. He doesn't want to even call it wrestling. That was something I heard Michael say earlier. What is qualified as professional wrestling? WWE is not professional wrestling. They're the WWE.
Thank you.
I consider myself to be the only true last, we're the last dying breed. I still have the wrestling king of sports on all of our advertisements that was used in the 40s and 50s. Because I want people to look at it and go, that's something I remember from when I was a kid.
Well, it's really sad. You know, I mean, it's pathetic. It's just pathetic.
I gotta say this real fast. I know Bobby Simmons, I know Michael Norris, but the person on the show that made the book is Jerry Oates. Because my pastor helped me edit the book and put it together, and he grew up in Savannah, Georgia, and his favorite wrestlers as a young man was Ted and Jerry Oates.
Well, I'll be darned.
And
I appreciate that.
He talks about that in the book, and then I talked to him today and told him I was going to be on here, and he said he was devastated when Pac saw him, took the chops to your knee and put you out of action.
Yeah, that was my first surgery. Well, I can't believe he remembered that.
Yeah.
But it's something that, you know, like Dickie, I'm in awe of his career, you know, I mean, because his dad did it, and Dickie got to travel the world as a young kid, and, you know, and it's, you know, I respect what I did on account of him, you know, I had a great, I had a great teacher, and, you know, I thank him for that, but, you know, we all just sit here, and all we can do is talk about it now, and it hurts, you know, it really does.
Yeah. That's, I heard you say a few weeks ago, you said the thing you miss the most is the boys.
Yep.
Well, I'm still in the dressing room every week, and I miss the boys, because they're not there anymore. They're not there.
That's a good way of putting it.
I
know how your pastor feels, Bo. I used to go when I was a little boy and watch Jerry wrestle, too. He was one of my favorites.
You did.
One whole chapter in my book is things that I miss. And it talks about just being in the dressing room. Guys reading the newspaper, playing cards. You don't see any of that now. It's a bunch of punks in there rehearsing and playing.
I don't think they can read.
No. and the other thing that I still have a problem with everything being so open. Because I remember a speech that I got from a man by the name of Rick Connors when I was 15 years old. He said, look, this is our life and this is our livelihood. And if you ever open your mouth about it, they're going to find you floating in the Holston River over here.
Uh-huh.
And I believed him. Yeah, Rick Connors. And I still watch the news every day to see about all these wrestlers floating up on the beaches everywhere.
but you know the sad part about it, you know many of the guys and nearly all the guys that you know in our era or before us that call in, I mean most of them have got you know artificial knees, artificial hips. They got all kind of problems, and I mean. I know Dickie's had a knee or two replaced, and I need two knees replaced, and shoulders don't work anymore. And you know, but we'd all do it again. But I'm
the same way. My shoulder's bad. I've had the surgery on my back already. There's nothing else I want to do. And I wrestle hurt. I still do it. We all did it. But that's the problem too. Is a guy now trying to run towns. A guy will call you and say, look, I can't come. I've got diarrhea, or I've got this. Or I said, you better be there, plain and simple, because there's no excuse for not being here. And I said, just the fact that you called me says you're doubting my ability to learn to take care of you, to make sure you make it through the night and the people see you because you're advertised.
Right.
They don't care about that.
They don't care about
the profession at all.
But see, it's
you're right. Let me tell you one thing. Tom Lanesto was the type of guy who would tell you, show up anyway. I remember Jerry Oates was supposed to be booked in Athens, Georgia. And when Jerry showed up in the dressing room, Jerry was sick. And the booker came in and he says, what's going on? And I says, Tom, I said, Jerry's sick. He said, what are you talking about? I says, he says he's got a bad back. He said, are you serious? I says, yeah, he's hurt. Tom goes over to Jerry and he says, get dressed. He's been told that he's got a bad back, can't work, and now he's been told to get dressed. So Jerry gets dressed. And sure enough, the booker, with this brilliant idea, had Jerry walk to the ring. As long as he can get up on the stairs and go up on an apron, somebody ran his head into the post. His brother came to his rescue. He jumped in the ring against Wayne Cowan. The excitement went on. Before you know it, they hauled Jerry back to the dressing room, and the match started. It wasn't booked that way, but that's the way it started. That's because of a good booker, somebody who calls their shots way ahead of time.
Yeah, and the fact that Jerry was a professional. You know, you try to tell a guy that now, he goes, I'm not going out there unless I get to do my moonsault. and I can't do it
because
I'm hurting.
Stop right there. That's when somebody in the dressing room should have the authority to say, get your bags back and get the hell out of here. I'll change the matches around. And every one of those other wrestlers who watch that booker say that will all of a sudden fall in line and say, I don't want to leave tonight. Because I got my mother and father out there watching me. What do you want me to do? That's the problem with your business today. Nobody has authority in their dressing room.
I'll tell you something else, too, that I heard in one of them little independent shows is they won't go out now unless they got their music.
Yeah, oh, God. Here's one. They come to me everywhere I go and go, I need your music. I said, I don't have any. So then they'll give me a list of songs that they'll play. I said, no, listen, I don't want it. Don't play anything. I just want to go to the ring. If everybody else has got it, I want to be a little different. They don't get that.
They don't get it. No, they don't.
And I'm still well known for, you know, just slapping somebody in the dressing room here. Because it happened to me when I broke in. I saw it happen to a lot of people. You know, and my wife tells me all the time, we're going to get sued. Somebody's going to sue us.
You sound like one of the boys.
That may be the greatest compliment I've got today.
Well, you're right.
There's no brotherhood. There's no camaraderie of it. There's no professionalism left. I mean, and that's, now, it's a little different here because my cousin wrestles, my brother-in-law wrestles, my wife wrestles, I wrestle, my mom runs the concession, my sister runs the box office. It's our family business. We protect it. You know, but you just go, like I say, Newport, Tennessee. I saw pictures. There was not one pair of wrestling trunks or one pair of boots in six matches. A thing I saw from there.
What is that? What do you have, gym shoes on or something?
Yeah, and camouflage shorts or just whatever they wore to work that day. They went over to the matches and, you know. But there's, it's, I tell these guys, hey, here's the only way you get them to stop running. Let the Vince McMahon book a show at the Viking Hall or Freedom Hall, and they won't run that week because they all save their money up to go to the matches.
They need to do what they need. Hey, Dickie, they need to do what Eddie used to do: send Roop around to their matches and challenge their main eventers.
That's right.
Yeah, but the problem is there's very few that could challenge them, and on the other side of that, they don't have any main eventers. It's just,
well, let me ask you one thing. Let's be the forum here. Let me just ask you, how many shooters do you have?
Oh, there's none left. I mean, my brother-in-law wrestled in college, you know, but I'm no shooter by no means, but I was raised in this business from 13 years old up. I do know
what I'm saying is, do you have an army of shooters,
yeah,
or guys who can,
yeah,
take care of themselves?
I've got a group of guys. My little crew here, we stick together. But if you go over here and kill this one, there's going to be another set there tomorrow.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is,
there's no end to it. There's nobody to stop them. No matter how bad we beat these guys up, break their legs, break their jaws, somebody will be there tomorrow.
I'm a chess player. Let me tell you what I would do. I would have you guys call yourself a certain whatever it is, and you had the certain T-shirts or whatever it is, and this is a unit you have, and then you advertise yourself as the real wrestling, and when you get out there, you have those real matches, and the people will pay. When my dad promoted in Orlando, Florida, he promoted on Monday night, every Monday night. And Sol Weingroff came into Orlando as the opposition. And he went to the newspaper and he says, I would like to buy an ad. And my dad had that standard ad every Monday night. And the newspaper told my dad's publicity man that the opposition was there and they were going to put an ad in there. And my dad's publicity man said, well, let's put the ad on the third page. You know what my dad told him? No, you put that ad right next to mine. So Sol Weingroff's ad was right on that newspaper, and right next to that newspaper was my dad's ad. And you know what my dad's ad says? You people watched TV last week. You know what the main event this coming Monday night is. I've been here 18 years. What you see on this page is your decision. You can go on a Tuesday night to wherever you want to go, or come to a Monday night to my matches, or go to the other side of town. And Sol Weingroff told me years later, he folded because of that. That Monday night,
yeah,
he folded.
But, okay, but here's the problem with that. Sol Weingroff had wrestlers that he had to pay. He had a budget of advertisement that he had to meet. They don't have that now because you can run a show now for $4.
I hold it right
there.
You
can get your 50 flyers made, find your building, put it up. You don't have to pay anybody that gets in the ring because there's enough guys that's going to
right
show
there.
Up
hold
and
right
see
there.
The flyers.
All right, hold it right there. I understand that. Now, here's your solution to that. You need a backer. You need somebody who is a lawyer or somebody who is in the finance business who's willing to donate $20,000 and take a tax write-off to support an association that you have, and you go down and get yourself a license, and they will back you. There was plenty of people who will do that.
Yeah, well, we're licensed. We're insured. We have all that to be covered. But here's the problem. In the last 15 years, there's been at least three schools in East Tennessee that's had wrestling matches that the wrestlers stole stuff out of the schools. All three times it made the newspaper.
Wow.
You've had a big star wrestler who lives in Bristol who was put in jail for a year and a half because he couldn't pay his child support. Front page of the newspaper.
Oh, that was... go ahead and say his name. Who cares?
Ricky Morton.
Ricky
Morton.
Ricky Morton, that's
yeah.
right.
You okay?
Yeah.
Then you got another guy. There's been about four other promoters that's left here over the years owing money to the TV stations, the radio stations, and whatnot. All that's made the press. All the people know is wrestling. So when you go say, hey, how would you like to sponsor wrestling? Oh, no. I don't want no part of that.
I can dig that. Yeah.
And there's just there's no way to get – it's the same thing. I used to run several fairs in West Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina. All of them paid towns. They paid me anywhere from $2,000 to $3,500 to bring wrestling there that night. A guy looked behind me, cut them all, and said, I'll do them for $500. But he didn't bring nearly the talent that I brought. Now, let's fast forward five more years, and another guy now got them because he does them for free.
Oh, gee whiz.
The fair doesn't have to pay a dollar, and they get wrestling matches.
Oh.
So how can you compete with that?
I don't know if they get wrestling matches or not. They get a bunch of guys in the ring.
Well, that's true. You got a ring, and that's the other problem. When I started promoting 23 years ago, I went and found one of the original rings from this territory here. It was in a barn with about 2 tons of hay and cow manure on top of it. I had to dig it out, take it, clean it up, fix it, weld it, do all that. It took me several weeks, if not months, to get the ring ready. Now I can drive to Charlotte, a couple grand, and I can buy and hook up to it and drive it home today.
That's true.
You want wrestling boots? When I was in the ring as a referee for a year, no one would tell me how to get a pair of wrestling boots. Now you can get on the internet and you can buy them and have them here tomorrow.
How much do they cost now?
Oh, if you want to get some. The cheap one's about $150. They'll last you about 3 months, and you're going to buy a new pair.
Oh, God, I am old. The first pair I bought was from K&H. I think I gave $8 or $10 for
it. Yeah. I had a pair, though. The ones I wear now are the ones Bill Ash made in 1985.
I've got a pair of Bill Ash boots in my closet right here.
And my wife, she bought boots out of Puerto Rico. They're real good boots. But anybody can get them. You want wrestling gear? Go to Google and type it in. So if you spend $300, you got an outfit, you got boots, you carry it into your local independent wrestling show and say, hey, I'm a wrestler, they're going to let you wrestle.
I'll give you a funny story.
For $100, you can be a champion. But if they come to me and they say, hey, I was a wrestler, I say, go buy a ticket. Because they didn't tell me, hey, I'm on the boys.
I'll give you a funny story. Dick, you'll like this. Ken Timms, who wrestled around here, and he passed away.
Juanita, his wife, she
makes wrestling gear, and she makes these little masks. They're just very, they just pull over your head. It's like a kid's mask.
Yeah.
And she sent me an email the other day. She said, I'm really in heaven tonight. She said, one of my little kids' masks that I sell for $5 at the shows, she said, I saw one on one of those midgets on that Hulk Hogan show.
Yeah. If you want to make money in a town, take your merchandise right in the dressing room. My wife sells more taking pictures in the dressing room than she does at the table. And most of the towns we go to.
Guys, we're down to about 10 seconds left. Boomer, I appreciate you joining us. We'll have to have you on where we can have you.
Anytime. I'm sitting home Thursday watching you. I may call in after Nick gets
call
done every week now.
Get
Bo back. We got to have Bo back on there.
As always, we appreciate you.
Real fast, kingofkingsport.com, go buy my book.
Talk about it next time.
Yeah.
We appreciate Billy Blake joining us. Guys, we'll get together again next Thursday and we'll do this again. We are out of time.
All right.
Good night, guys.
Good night, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Good night.
All right.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.